All right. Good afternoon, everybody. Hope you're doing well. Stéphane Molyneux from Free Domain. Sorry for last night. It did not quite go as planned, but we're back this afternoon. If you have questions, you can hit me up on the X space. Just request a talk. We can chat it out. And I certainly have a couple of the topics. So one I started talking about last night, which I'll refresh here, is that, you know, when you grow up poor, there's a certain amount of skepticism you have towards the hoity-toity stuff. You know, a certain amount of skepticism you have towards, oh, this is the best stuff. This is the greatest stuff. And wine was one of those things that just struck me as, you know, mostly bullshit. If that makes sense. I worked when I was Gosh, where did I work? After I left the theater school, before I went to McGill, I worked at a high-end seafood restaurant in downtown Toronto. I was a waiter. And it was one of my first exposures to people who have serious spending. You know, I remember serving a couple. The guy had just got some big promotion at work, and he dropped $1,000 on a bottle of champagne, some Dom Perignon kind of thing. And it was pretty wild. Like, I hadn't seen that kind of spending. I mean, I grew up mostly among poor people. I knew a few middle-class people. One guy I knew had a pool, but they weren't that kind of spenders. And I remember upselling profiteroles to people for dessert and all of that. And I tried a little bit. They left a little bit of the champagne. I tried a little bit before tossing the bottle, and it's like, yeah, it's nice. It's nice, but the amount of pretension and the amount of, well, I know the good stuff and this isn't the good stuff, all that kind of stuff. So I did look this up and I wanted to share it with you as a whole, which is people, what are they paying for? What do they pay for expensive stuff? Now, sometimes they're paying for quality. And my wife's father once said to her, "We're poor, so we have to buy the best because we can't afford to replace it." So if you're poor and you buy a cheap vacuum cleaner, you're just going to have to replace it in a couple of years. But if you're poor and you buy a really good vacuum cleaner, then you can keep it forever, right? So there are several well-known scientific studies and experiments that show that people can't really distinguish cheap from expensive wines in blind testings. And sometimes they actually prefer the cheaper ones. This isn't just like lay people. This isn't just normal people who like wine and consider themselves good at wine. These are like trained experts. So there was a study in 2008 by economist Robin Goldstein and colleagues. And this was published in the journal. there's a magazine for absolutely everything on this planet as a whole, but this was published in the Journal of Wine Economics. So, you know, if you want to figure out what happened, just go to your back issues. I'm sure you've got them stacked right by your couch. The Journal of Wine Economics, this is from 2008. So they analyzed over 6,000 blind tastings, wines served without price or label info. Key finding. So people, on average, I mean, they like wine, they consider themselves good at wine, they in taste tests, they consider themselves able. So it's not just some guy who's, I don't know, deconverted from Islam and is trying alcohol for the first time. So these are people who like wines, claim to really appreciate wines. And on average, they liked the more expensive wines less. Which is like every skepticism of bourgeois pomposity and vainglorious, oh, but this one has a light, fruity, Rubenesque flavor with a hint of wood chips. I mean, all this sort of nonsense. Like, they liked the more expensive wines less than the cheap wines. Other experts showed a link between price and rating, but very weak. Very weak. So if you don't know the price, most people do not derive more pleasure from pricier wines. So what are they paying for? What are they paying for? So there was a psychologist named Richard Wiseman did an experiment in 2011. He had 578 participants taste a range of wines blind. The prices were from £3.50 cheap to over £30. Expensive, that would be the equivalent of probably about $150 now. So how often did people identify which wine was cheap or which wine was expensive? 50% of the time. 50% of the time. Now, you would say, maybe they got it right 50% of the time. You would be wrong. What it means is that it's a coin flip. They have no idea. No idea whatsoever. It's like you flip a coin. Is it heads or tails? You'll get it right 50% of the time. Unless, you know, it was a kind of strange universe thing. My brother and I, when we were younger, he would do coin flips and he would say heads or tails to make a decision about what we do. And I always chose head because for me, head is thinking and tails is your ass. And I prefer thinking. Sometimes I prefer ass to thinking, but most times I would prefer thinking to ass. And tails seem to me like a monkey tail, like a bad thing. Head is the seat of reason. So I always chose head and I always lost. I cannot remember a single time. Now, I did obviously check to see if my brother had a double tail, like a dual ass coin. But no. No. So it was just the universe saying, you know, with some people, you just can't win. You will just never win. It was a pretty wild thing, though. So people identified the cheap wines versus the expensive wines 50% of the time. It was 53% for whites, 47% for reds. Now, I like it when whites beat reds for communist reasons, but there was no preference for expensive wines overall. Isn't that funny? So Plasman et al., 2008, Caltech, Stanford, used fMRI brain scans. Participants tasted the same wine, but were told different prices. So they were told, this wine bottle is only $5, this one's $45, this one's $10, this one's $90. They rated the expensive version as tasting better and showed more activity in the brain's reward pleasure centers, the medial orbitofrontal cortex. So the price changed their experience and their enjoyment. Their brain fired up and told them the wine was way more pleasurable when they were spending more. So people aren't buying the experience of tasting better wine. They're buying the experience of believing they're tasting better wine. In other words, they're paying for the dopamine, not based on the wine, but based on the price. Isn't that wild? What they're buying is the experience of thinking something is better without it actually being better. There was another one in 2001. Two, students tasted a white wine and a red wine. Later, they got the same white wine, one left white, one dyed red with an odorless and tasteless dye. They described the dyed red version using red wine terms, the red fruits and so on, and they ignored the actual flavors. Vision overrides taste or smell. If you believe that the wine is red, you will believe it has red fruity flavors, even though it doesn't. So, real world replications. This is YouTube Sommelier Challenges. Sommelier is somebody who literally trains for years to be good at wine. Cheap wines frequently score well or beat expensive ones blind. Isn't that wild? So people pay for dopamine not from the thing that is better. People pay for dopamine because of the price. The price goes up, the dopamine goes up. And this has a lot of real-world implications. Yes. Let me get to your real-world questions and all of that. I'd love to hear that. Can I pop out this chat? Let's see here. Let's get to your questions and comments, and I'm happy to take questions on X. Damn, the fall of this dork is really sad. I love it. Love it. So, yeah, my life is pretty great, honestly. I just release, and you should really go and check this out. Maybe James can throw it in the chat. I just released, it was my first in-person interview in like 6 years. I went down to Sam Hyde's studio and we did a couple of hours on a variety of topics. And Sam brought in some people for some real brief live call-in shows where people came in with their personal issues, and I brought the power of philosophy to bear and self-knowledge to bear on those issues. Pretty wild. It was pretty wild and really great to have that kind of eye contact being in the same room, because that's not the kind. I mean, call-in shows are audio only for the most part, and people almost never do video based on my requests. So I hope that you will go and check that out. It's doing 310 plus thousand views on YouTube, which is nice. You know, that's a higher videos views than I've had in a while. And you can also watch, so you can watch an hour and a half of it on YouTube. Just do a search for Sam Hyde, Stefan Molyneux, although you still can't find me on YouTube. Boy, they hold a grudge for like multi-generations over there at YouTube. So you can go and do a search for that video, watch it the first hour and a half, the 2.5 hour version, I think 2:40 maybe, you can get on Sam Hyde's website and you can subscribe and watch it there. So it's, I think it's worth watching the extra stuff. We got into a lot more detail with some people. And so, yeah, pretty good life. So, you know, you guys need to, you need to learn to not feed the trolls. You know, somebody saying, damn, the fall of this dork is really sad, right? So, so let's say that I'm a total dork and I've fallen far from grace, right? Okay. Hey, maybe I fell down the mountain, but bro, at least I was on top of the mountain. And for a moralist to face castigation, hostility, and deplatforming from society, that means you're good at your job, right? You understand? If I was a doctor and I cured someone of an illness, they wouldn't come back to me for that cure. They would no longer leave me because I was a good doctor. They wouldn't need me anymore. I would be, quote, deplatformed. If a patient keeps coming back, it's because I haven't cured them, right? And so if somebody comes along and says, Steph, you used to get a lot more views than you get now. You used to be a lot more prominent. At least I was prominent. I was like, for many years, I was like the number one intellectual in the world, the number one philosopher in the world. And that is, that's not an easy thing to achieve. And I was not a cowardly philosopher. I have a tendency towards foolhardiness. And, I know this sounds like a humble brag. Well, I have a tendency to just be a little too courageous, don't you know? It's like, no. Like, it genuinely is a fault. You know, like, I'm going to go pet the lion, right? It genuinely is a fault. It's foolhardiness. And so, yeah, I flew close to the sun. I did a lot of good in the world. And then I got the blowback that moralists get when you do a lot of good in the world, right? The only way to be a moralist and not be deplatformed is to not do any particular good in the world. Because when you actually do good in the world, practical, tangible, measurable good, you provoke evildoers and then they strike back at you. They can't win the argument, right? People didn't win the argument with me. They just deplatformed me. It's kind of like, if you've trained for 5 years for some title fight and then you can't wait to get in the ring and fight, and then they just call in an airstrike or poison you or something like that, or pull a Tonya Harding and, you know, whack you in the side of your arm with a big metal pipe and then you can't fight. It's not a fair fight, right? So when people say, and it's interesting, right? So when people say, what was it? The fall of this dork is really sad. You got to go through a non-reactive process to something like that. Like, I'm begging y'all. Like, you got to show some wisdom and some maturity. I'm sorry to be nagging and annoying everyone, but it is really, really important. You have to say, this is just somebody who's goading. And it's very easy to say, well, Steph's had a fall from grace when you've never been high up, right? The deal is, as a moral philosopher, you have to push the envelope to improve humanity, and then humanity is going to have its blowback. The evildoer is going to have this blowback. So if somebody says, damn, the fall of this dork is really sad, that is a goading statement, right? Please, please do not fall into the trap of being goaded by losers. So let's say I'm a total dork and a total loser. Then if this guy is not a total dork or a loser, why is he here nagging and complaining, right? Or putting people down, right? I mean, let's say that I'm a dork and a loser. If somebody follows me around calling me a dork and a loser rather than go and achieve things with their own life, that's double sad. At least I, at one point, wasn't a dork and a loser according to this metric. So, yeah, just don't fall for this this kind of stuff. You can say, tell me what, damn, the fall of this dork is really sad. I mean, if you want to respond at all, just say, hey, what have you achieved? Link me to your big giant website. Like, I've literally had 1 billion views and downloads of my material. 1 billion views and downloads. I've prevented close to 2 billion assaults upon children. I've changed the discourse of very important things in the world, pushed the Overton window. And there are fewer viewers now than in my heyday. And it's sort of like saying, like, if I was the biggest music act in the world, and then I'm not playing stadiums anymore, I'm playing clubs, and people say, oh man, he used to play stadiums, what a fall from grace. It's like, did you ever play stadiums? Did you? Did you ever reach the summits? Did you ever take big risks? Did you ever reach the top of your profession? Okay, maybe you can't stay there, but have you ever been playing stadiums? Oh man, he used to play stadiums, now he just plays clubs. It's like, yeah. And that's actually quite common. That's quite common in the world. I mean, except for like boomer nostalgic acts and so on, right? Like the Rolling Stones and so on. But if people are like, man, he used to play stadiums, he used to be the number one music act in the world, and now he's playing clubs. And it's like, well, did you ever play stadiums? have you ever even played a club? I love it. So yes, these are the chats that I read. And say, hey, if you know how to do what I do better than I do, look, which is fine. Look, I've no objection to that. I mean, I'm putting a movie together about my theory of ethics, and in it I talk about somebody getting perfect on an exam, and then he holds it up, and the exam, and it's a picture of me, or it's a video of me, and the exam he gets perfect marks on is how to destroy your social media career. So look, if you are able to take on the immoralities and evils of the world, and you are able to sustain that, and you're able to keep it going, and you're able to survive in a way that nobody's ever been able to survive before, right? I mean, to get to the top and to really alter the moral mindset and mechanics of mankind is a very challenging, difficult. I mean, look what happened to Jordan Peterson. I mean, Jordan Peterson got addicted to benzodiazepines, I'm sure, to help manage stress and sleeplessness, because he was bigger than me after a while. I helped get him started to some degree, and then he became way bigger than me for a while. But then he also avoided particular topics, like he didn't do IQ, and he openly said, I'm not going to do IQ. There were other topics he just avoided. And then he ended up signing up with CAA, which was the agent or management representation team that also was very happy to do business with Harvey Weinstein and so on, right? So, I mean, whatever, bit of a deal with the devil in my view. And then a guy gets addicted to benzodiazepines and says he was awake for like, what was it, a week or two, which is not physically possible. And then he ended up with this horrible addiction. I think his daughter's husband or something like that got him over to Russia, where they put him in a coma to detox him. And now he's dealing with akathisia, which is, I think, one of the after effects of benzodiazepines. So, I mean, that's terrible. And I have sympathy for the guy. I mean, you know, I have sympathy for the guy. It's a tough world being out there trying to wrestle with the hateful anti-rationalities of the planet. I mean, it's a tough gig. So, you know, I say this with no criticism. And, you know, people like Joe Rogan have maintained their influence only by making horrible compromises, right? Like he does a deal with, I think, Tencent owns Spotify. Tencent is in league with the Chinese Communist Party. And he doesn't challenge the drug addictions of his audience, or he doesn't really deal with child abuse or anything like that. And Amy turned on me, but, you know, this is so long ago, who cares, right? But so if somebody is like, Steph, you made a mess of things, you should have stayed at the top in your career as a public, rational, moral philosopher, you should have stayed at the top, I'm like, please show me how. Like, if you can do something better. Like, when was the last time Paul McCartney had a hit song? You know, let me ask you this. When was the last time Paul McCartney, I think it's been many decades, right? Paul McCartney had a top 10 song. And Paul McCartney had a top 10 song, right? Let's find out. Maybe it's more recent than I think. No, he did a collaboration with Rihanna, Kanye West, and Paul McCartney in 2015. So he had a song called Spies Like Us, which was from the movie, number 7 in 1986. No More Lonely Nights in 1984. Right? That's a long ass time ago. And listen, right? So 40 years ago. So 40 years ago, he had a non-collaboration number one hit, right? Peaked at number 3 in 2015. So if you say, oh, Paul McCartney hasn't had a hit in 40 years, right? It's true. And there have been some disappointing albums from people that I used to like. Paul McCartney's last album, I listened to it. His voice is totally shot. And maybe he can belt it to Ringo Starr, but in the studio, it just sounds horrible. And Yes is a band I used to really like. My teenage years were a battle between Pink Floyd and Yes for the future of my soul. It was Mother, Do You Think They'll Drop the Bomb versus It Can Happen by Yes. Lovely, positive song. And I mean, I don't even know the last time that I guess it would be more Roger Waters and David Gilmour. When was the last time they had a top 10? Decades ago. And I listened to the last album by Yes, or at least a couple of years ago. Just terrible. Just terrible. I mean, I liked two albums by John Anderson, Animation and Elias of Sun Hilo. And, no, sorry, Song of Seven. Elias of Sun Hilo wasn't that great. Yeah, Song of Seven was great. Animation was great. And I listened to City of Angels, and there's only one good song on it. The rest of it was just absolutely terrible. And I'm open to new artists, like open to artists doing different stuff and all of that. I was a big fan of Alan Parsons, and they released the album Gandhi, and I never listened to anything again, because if they let something that bad get through, I'm not. So you can say, oh my God, it's he used to do all of this great stuff, and now he doesn't do this great stuff. It's like, hey man, if Paul McCartney hasn't had a hit that he's solo on in 42 years or over 40 years, and then say, well, he's not doing any good music now. Okay, fine. Then what you need to do is be as big as Paul McCartney, but keep it sustained. And of course, people aren't doing that. So yeah, just don't be goaded by losers. They'll just drag you down into their mindset and beat you with experience. All right, we have Una Colère. If you have a question, comment, please feel free to unmute. Going once, going twice. All right. It looks like he's not coming in.
Wait, can you hear me?
Oh, are you back?
Yes, sorry. I was a little behind for some reason.
No problem at all. Happy to
anyway,
hear.
Anyway, how are you?
I'm well. How are you doing?
I'm doing really well, I suppose. So the reason I called in was, I kind of wanted to follow up on a conversation we had. I don't remember if it was last time or the time before that. This is the third time I called in. I don't know if you remember me.
Go ahead.
Okay. So last time we talked a bit about Elon Musk. I consider myself to be, I guess what you could loosely call a Musk scholar. And we talked a bit about his father who... he ended up having a kid with his stepdaughter. So I ended up looking more into this, and what I found turned out to be quite dark, actually. Apparently members of the Musk family...
Okay, so sorry, just before you go into that, I just want to make sure that you're certain of this information, because I certainly don't want you broadcasting anything negative about people that you're not certain of.
Well, I'm not 100% certain, but from what I've gathered, I think, if I could put it bluntly, I believe it is more than 50% that that Elon Musk's father is a pedophile. Yeah.
Okay, so why would you not be certain of that? And why would you broadcast that about someone? I mean, I've been lied about quite a bit, and I'm not saying he is or he isn't, I don't know. But shouldn't you be kind of responsible before you put information like that out in the public square and be certain?
Well, I'm not the first person to put it out there.
I don't care if you're the first person or not. I mean, right? It doesn't matter to me if you're the first person or not. What matters is you're responsible for what you do. You can't just follow the herd. And if other people have said things that are not true...
Well, I can tell you why I believe this. Okay. First off, there are accusations coming from the Musk family against his father that he apparently molested his adopted daughter at the age of 6.
Okay, so hang on. Has that been proven?
No, it has not been proven in a court of law, but I've heard that Elon Musk himself, some of the things he's said, has indicated that that this is probably true. He has described his father as having done every evil you can think of. This is a rough quote, like a paraphrase. And he has cut all contact with his father.
Okay, so let me just, this is from Grok. Did Elon Musk's father have a child with his stepdaughter? Yes, according to multiple reports and public statements from Errol Musk himself. Errol Musk, Elon Musk's father, has 2 children with Jana Bezuidenhout, who was his former stepdaughter.
Bezuidenhout,
thank you. Errol married Jana's mother in early 1990s. At the time, Jana was about 4 years old. Errol helped raise her along with her siblings during the marriage, which ended in divorce after a few years. Years later, after the divorce, Errol and Jana entered a romantic relationship as adults. They have a son, Elliot Rush, a daughter born around 2019. Errol has publicly discussed the relationship in interviews, describing it as completely normal and emphasizing reproduction as a key purpose in life and all of this. So that is appalling. Yeah, I mean, to me, that is absolutely corrupt and evil. So I'm with you. I mean, as to whether he molested her when she was a child, let me just, again, I'm just trying to get some facts here because having been subject to falsehoods myself, I obviously want to be very sure. Are there accusations of molestation? Okay. But yeah, you can't be having children with your stepkids. That's just, I mean, even though they're not genetically related to you, but it's absolutely horrendous.
Time.
Yeah, absolutely horrendous. All right, let me just see here. Yes, there are serious accusations of child sexual abuse against Errol Musk. A September 2025 investigation by the New York Times reported that Errol Musk had been accused of sexually abusing 5 of his children and stepchildren, with allegations spanning from 1993 to as recently as 2022. The earliest reported allegation involves Jana, this woman, his former stepdaughter, with whom he later had 2 children. At age 4, she allegedly told family members that he had touched her inappropriately. A decade later, she reportedly accused him of other inappropriate behavior, e.g. sniffing her underwear. Other accusations involve 2 of his biological daughters and a stepson, according to family members, police court records, social workers, and interviews. Police investigations were opened in some cases, but no charges resulted in convictions. Outcomes varied, some closed without charges. Errol Musk has denied all the allegations, calling them false nonsense and claiming they stem from family attempts to extort Elon Musk or other motives. So, it hasn't been proven in a court of law. He denies it, but the accusations are there. So my apologies for going for the fact check, but I felt it was important. So please go ahead.
No, of course. Yeah. So it appears to me that he has groomed this girl from a very young age. Would you agree with that?
I mean, there certainly does seem to be indications, and it is certainly a very bizarre thing to have children with a girl you raised from a very early age. That is just horrendous.
Yeah, so that's one of the reasons why I believe that this is likely. But well, the main reason I brought this up is because, as you can imagine, Elon Musk is one of the most powerful individuals in the world. And I think it's important to understand his psyche, given the fact that his father is, in all likelihood, a child molester, you know.
And you're right about what Elon said. 2017 Rolling Stone interview, Elon said, quote, "He was such a terrible human being. My dad will have a carefully thought out plan of evil. He will plan evil. Almost every crime you can possibly think of, he has done. Almost every evil thing you could possibly think of, he has done. It's so terrible, you can't believe it."
Yeah, well, there he obviously insinuates it, you know.
Yes, I think you're right. And given that people would very much be happy to sue Elon Musk, he probably can't get into specifics because even his own father might sue him for defamation or something like that. So, and of course, this yeah. is the question of like why on earth would his mother have children with such an evil man?
Well, he doesn't seem to have much of a, he seems to have a very poor choice in woman himself.
True.
Yeah, except maybe the one that I think also works for him, but they don't appear to have been romantically involved. The other thing is, I don't remember. Do you remember the pedo guy fiasco where he accused some guy who were helping children escape a cave of being a pedophile? Do you remember that?
Yes, and that went to a lawsuit for defamation, which I believe Elon Musk won, or at least was not found to be liable. Is that right?
Yeah, but the reason I brought that up is because I think this is probably a sensitive topic for him. This is likely how that thing started in the first place.
Yeah. And it's always tough to me. And of course, not that he ever would, but if he ever did a call-in show with me, then I would say, so his mother, May, married Errol Musk in 1970. Right. They had three children, and they divorced in 1979. And after the divorce, the children initially split time. Elon briefly lived with Errol, which he later regretted. And so it is wild to me, because this is the mother who decided to marry this guy. Now, I think Errol Musk really pursued her and all of that. And I think he said the marriage is happening, and just she got swept up in this sort of momentum and so on.
Yeah.
But it is pretty wild that she was that susceptible to who Elon Musk describes as a truly darkly evil man. And I don't know. I mean, obviously, I have no idea what their private conversations are, but of course, I would recommend saying, like, you're not going to be able to have successful relationships with women, I would say to Elon Musk, until you figure out what happened with your mother. Because a sexual desire would be dark and destructive, certainly for my Musk. I assume that Errol, I don't know, when he was younger, was he a good-looking guy? I assume he was, you know, tall, dark, handsome, charismatic. And so I assume it was a marriage based largely on lust and just going along with a stronger person's will.
He was rich.
I'm sorry?
He was rich.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. But there are rich guys who aren't evil, right?
No, I mean the reason she might have been attracted to him.
Well, sure. But there's evil guys. Sorry, there's guys who have money who aren't evil, right? Let me just just look for a picture of Errol Musk as a young man. Let's see what we've got here. Come on, you can find it. It's so funny how you get, good looking guy. Yeah, good looking guy.
I think Elon Musk is over 6 feet tall. I wouldn't really consider him to be attractive, but I'm not a woman and I'm not gay either, so maybe I'm not the best person to judge.
6'2".
Ah,
so he
nice.
was tall, decent looking, wealthy, guy, right? So yeah. I assume that his, yeah, and I see pictures of him. He's a good looking guy. I mean, he's got that kind of Dutch look, which is maybe not your taste or whatever, but obviously it's to the taste of Dutch women. I don't know if he's Dutch or not, but I assume it's some sort of Boer connection or something like that.
Well, no, I am of Dutch connection, but I believe his father is like half Dutch, half Canadian, if I got it right.
All right. So she was very pretty. She became a model, I think, in the 70s. So Mae Musk is very pretty. Errol Musk, tall, good looking. I think he kept his hair, didn't he?
No, it could be implants. I know.
Oh,
Elon
yeah, but
implants.
Either way, right? I mean, I know Elon Musk has like implants for sure. I mean, there's no question of that, right? So, yeah, he kept his hair and he kept his, hair at 80, which is very unusual. And so when he was younger, guys who have children later on in life almost always have kept their hair or, you know, at least look that way. So for Mae Musk and Errol Musk back in the day, I assume that their decision to marry and have children and so on and stay together for almost 10 years was based on lust. It was based on physical attraction and so on. It was not based upon qualities of character for him, and it certainly couldn't have been based on qualities of character for her, because if she marries and gives three children to a truly evil guy, as he's described, then she lacks qualities of character, or she lacks qualities of submission, right? So let's see, how old?
What do you mean by that?
Yeah, that's a fine question. Let me just see, how old was Mae Musk when she got married? I think she was quite young. Got married. So I think she was pretty young. I'm thinking early 20s. Let's just see what comes, early mid-20s, but I think she was quite young. Yeah, she was 21 or 22 years old when she got married. And she had known Errol Musk for years by this point.
There's also a bit of a question of just how consensual this relationship was. I think you said earlier he did very aggressively pursue her, maybe even coerce in a way.
Well, so here's the story. They attended the same high school in Pretoria, South Africa. I've actually been there. Errol was interested in Mae for several years, actively pursued her. She was a standout. She was a finalist in the 1969 Miss South Africa beauty competition and already modeling. They began dating seriously as young adults. The wedding was a double wedding with Mae's twin sister Kay and her partner, a detail Mae has mentioned in her interviews. And Mae has described the marriage as increasingly controlling and abusive, emotionally, verbally, and physically. She felt isolated, with Errol allegedly cutting her off from family and friends and all of that stuff. And I'm going to ask how did he pursue her? And I'm asking this for a particular reason, to do with her lack of submission. Let me just see what there is. He pursued her persistently, and he chased her for about 7 years before they got married. Mae was initially hesitant. She said she didn't want to date him because he had a reputation for being mean or a womanizer. But as a self-described nerd who didn't get many dates, she eventually started seeing him. I don't believe that a woman who's a finalist in a countrywide beauty competition is having trouble getting any male attention. That doesn't really...
Yeah, I agree with that.
Right. So the reason I talk about submission is, this is true for men and women, but we're talking about Mae Musk as a young woman. So if Mae Musk comes from a decent family, then who should be evaluating her potential husband?
Well, maybe her parents herself, maybe?
Sure, her parents.
Or both, I guess.
Yeah. Because if you're 21 or 22 and you're getting married, you have almost no life experience and you've been very coddled and in the conveyor belt or train track of school. And if you have a good family, then you've not been exposed to evildoers. Now, if you have a good family, the one thing that's true about good people, as I was talking about earlier in the show, the one thing that's true about good people is we know evildoers, because when you're good, you end up being opposed and attacked by evildoers. So her family, if they're a good family, then they would evaluate him and say, he's got a bad reputation. He comes from a bad family. He's got a high body count. He's controlling. And they would go and talk to his ex-girlfriends like you would do your vetting. You got to vet the men that your children marry. You have to, because we all know young people, and there's nothing wrong with it. Why has lust become so powerful for young people? Because lust was contained and restrained and controlled by parental evaluation, right? So the young people can afford to be crazy lusty because the parents won't let them get married to a bad guy just because he's tall, good looking, wealthy, or whatever it is, right? So
I think contraceptives also play an important role, because in the past you couldn't really mess around without either getting pregnant, getting someone pregnant, or getting some kind of STD.
Right, right. So young people should listen to their elders when it comes to dating. And I know the boomers completely gave up on that and just let people date whoever they want. But young people should listen to their elders about who to marry. And this guy had red flags, right?
What would you say are all those red flags besides being promiscuous?
Well, he was mean.
Yeah.
He had a reputation for being mean and a bit of a womanizer, and she didn't want to date him.
Go on.
So May said, Errol seems charming and ambitious. He was an engineering student, but she later realized there were controlling tendencies even before the wedding. She had doubts going into the wedding, but proceeded anyway. Go ahead.
No, you may go ahead.
Well, so his her father and mother, I think in particular it should be the father. Men understand male evil in a way that women don't, because male evil is more in your face when you're a man. Male evil is often covered up in the face of females because it's a form of camouflage, right? So
can I maybe focus a bit more on Elon Musk himself? I should probably have mentioned this earlier, but it is alleged that there is not a lot of evidence for this. This is this actually is just an allegation that maybe not that well substantiated, but apparently he was molested himself as a child by sailors on a boat or something.
I'm sorry, who was molested?
Errol Musk.
Errol Musk.
Father.
Well, I mean, if somebody is going to have a wildly immoral and inappropriate relationship with the stepdaughter he raised, clearly I would assume that sexual boundaries were violated. It's not proof. This is my assumption, that sexual boundaries would have been violated by that person early on.
Yeah, I think it's probably more than likely true.
So the question is, with May Musk, this charming, pretty mean, kind of womanizing guy is chasing her, and the father has to evaluate and talk to the family and talk to the young man and try and suss him out. Because as a father, when you have a daughter or a son, or both, as a father, who your children choose to marry is who your genetics get intertwined with. And a lot of personality traits are genetic. And so all of the work that you've done to raise your kids, you should pour at least a good portion of that work into evaluating who they're dating and who they might marry, who they're going to have children with. Because you're blending two families together. You are then joining your fortunes together with an entire other family. So you really better make sure that family is good, is not evil as a whole, and doesn't have, you know, crazy major dysfunctions and things like that, right?
Yeah. How do you think this affected Elon Musk himself? Because, of course, if, I don't like to say this, but if your parents are pedophile, then it's likely that the children will also be one. I don't know if he sexually abused Elon himself. Maybe he was just into boys. There are, of course, no evidence that Elon ever did this sort of thing, despite what some people might say. I actually had an argument in front of your comment sections with a guy who accused him of being on Epstein Island.
I don't think he was, though. I don't think he was.
No, he wasn't. He got invited two times, but he declined one time, and the other time, like the schedule, Epstein said the schedule won't work. So he canceled it himself, Epstein, that is.
Right. So I would say, and I think about this with regards to Elon Musk and Amber Heard. Now, I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that Amber Heard is quite mental, based upon what sort of came out of the Johnny Depp stuff and all that. Even if we take the extreme stuff, like dropping a number two on the bed and so on. I mean, she is very high-strung, aggressive, unempathetic, I would argue abusive, and I think that's fairly clear as you sort of see these kinds of things. So if Elon Musk doesn't know why his mother chose an evil guy to have three children with and stay with him for, I mean, to know him for close to a decade and a half and to be married with him for 9 years and to date him before that. If Elon Musk doesn't know why his mother chose an evildoer, he will be unable to choose a virtuous woman.
Well, seems to be the case so far.
I mean, what was the last one? Ashley Sinclair. I mean, of all the people, right? I mean, good Lord. Good Lord. So, if his mother chose his father for height, looks, charm, and status, and Elon Musk chooses women for looks, charm, status, or whatever, right? Then Elon Musk is continuing his mother's mistake. And I would assume because his mother hasn't dug in deep and said, well, either, because she knew that he was a bad guy before she even married him. So why did she marry him? I mean, if her father, and I don't know the answer to this, maybe it's in the book, but if May Musk's father said, don't marry the guy, but then you have to follow through. Like if a father doesn't, like he's really opposed to the guy his child is marrying, then he should in no way, shape, or form support the wedding. Now, I don't know. Again, I'd have to sort of read the whole biography thing and find out if she went to the wedding or if he went to the wedding or whatever. I guess she did, right? She was there. But was she advised against it and didn't listen? Has she owned and accepted the fact that she got married to and gave three children to an evildoer? Has she figured out why? Has she apologized? Has she, I don't know, done whatever therapy she would need? Did she reject her father? Why did she reject her father? And so on. Or did her father not warn her against this bad guy? In which case, the father can't see bad guys. The wife, his daughter can't see bad guys. And I don't think Elon Musk can see bad women. And so he can't really pair a bond. He follows lust, I assume. He follows looks and so on. I haven't seen pictures of all of his girlfriends or the mothers of his children, but I mean, the ones I've seen, they're all very good looking. And again, it's nothing wrong with looks and all of that, but I don't think that the deep dive has been done between Elon and his mother as to why this, you know, seems like a pretty monstrously evil guy ended up as his father.
Yeah, I think one of, he wasn't romantically involved with her, but they had children together. I can't remember her name, but I believe she works at Neuralink.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, I forgot her name. You can look her up if you want.
But, sorry, what's the point of that?
What do you mean? No, I'm just saying he did have children with one woman who didn't seem to be so bad.
Well, of course, there are some women who are good looking and very virtuous. I like to think my wife is one of them. So the fact that he's drawn to looks and doesn't particularly as much care about virtue, which is his parents, right?
The women he married are quite successful. Amber Heard at the time was a very popular actress, or I don't know if she did, how organic it was, but she was kind of everywhere.
Right.
I have to go now.
Okay. Appreciate the call. If you can just make sure you hang up, I've lost the interface. So, it is an interesting question. You know, we can always learn from other people's mistakes. Hopefully people can learn from my mistakes as well. I did ask AI, did her parents approve of the marriage? It says there's limited public detail on whether Musk's parents fully approved of her marriage to Errol Musk. Available accounts suggest it was not strongly opposed and proceeded despite some reservations. May's parents were Canadian adventurers, chiropractors, pilots, and explorers, moved the family to South Africa in 1950. And they were known for independent thinking and non-traditional lifestyles. They flew the family around the world in a small plane. So adventurous, you know, Errol Flynn, right? And in her memoir and interviews, May does not describe strong parental opposition. The marriage happened relatively young and quickly, and her parents appear to have accepted it at the time. And then May's parents were no longer a major influence by the time problems arose in the marriage. Joshua Haldeman died in 1974 in a plane crash before the divorce. So, yeah, I don't, it doesn't seem that the parents had any particular opposition. And it is, you know, it is one of the problems because before the welfare state, before alimony, child support, palimony, and all this sort of stuff, before all of that, parents had a significant degree of influence over who their children would marry, which is why the traditional argument is that you would go to your girlfriend's parents to ask permission for her hand in marriage because the parents had to approve. Now, why did the parents have to approve? Because in the past, of course, if the marriage didn't work out, then the woman would end up having to move back in with her parents. And so if the parents said, you really can't get married to this guy, and then she disagrees with them, she's taking a huge risk, which is that they may not take her and her kids back in if the marriage breaks up. So, but of course, with the welfare state and the government shoveling money from men to women as a whole, women no longer have to listen to their parents. And a very foundational restraint upon youthful lust is taken away. I mean, when I was younger, and this is no blame for anyone. I mean, of course, right? I mean, I wasn't making wise dating decisions when I was 18 or 19 or 20 or 21. 22 was perfect. No, I mean, I wasn't making the best decisions. But then I had no parental feedback on anything about anything and no social or feedback about anything. But one of the reasons why the marriage rate was so bad was that when the welfare state came in, women in particular no longer had to care about their father's perspective on whether this guy was a good or bad guy. I mean, if you look at something like 50 Shades of Grey, right? The most popular book apparently ever written outside of the Bible. I mean, this one's Bible dictated by God, 50 Shades of Grey dictated by Satan, of course. I mean, if your daughter wanted to date a guy who could only get a boner by beating the crap out of her, of course you would say, like, I don't care how much money he has, like, you can't sell your soul that way, and you certainly can't raise children in that kind of environment, right? That's just the basic reality. That's just the basic reality. So yeah, it is brutal. Women don't have to listen to men anymore because they can just go and screw up, and then they get child support, alimony, they get welfare state, they're free healthcare, free dental care, free education for their kids and all that, quote free, right? So yeah, it is, it's horrendous. we don't have to listen to any of the wisdom of our elders. Now, of course, I'm not saying that the boomers have much wisdom at all, but... So, the divorce. When she got divorced, she faced significant legal and practical challenges during and after her divorce in 1979. It was a decade-long ordeal to get divorced. The divorce occurred in 79, May was 31, Elon was 8, Kimball 7, Tosca 5. South Africa's Divorce Act, which made divorce easier, including on grounds like abuse, was passed that same year. Before this, divorce was very difficult, especially with children, which is why May said she stayed in the marriage longer than she wanted. Errol fought for custody of the children and repeatedly sued May after the divorce. May said he accused her of being unfit, claiming she was malnourishing the children over minor issues like a blister or bruise on an active child. These lawsuits dragged on for years. May describes Errol throwing out the children's belongings when they visited him, forcing her to replace clothes and school items constantly. He allegedly used legal action to drain her resources and keep her in fear. As a single mother with limited income, working as a dietitian and model, she lived frugally, peanut butter sandwiches, bean soup, while dealing with constant legal stress. She said the post-divorce period was exhausting and frightening. Errol allegedly tried to control or isolate her even after separation, continuing patterns from the marriage. So she says she wanted to leave earlier, felt trapped by the law and circumstances. Once the new divorce law passed, she acted quickly. She moved with the children initially to Durban, later to Canada to rebuild. Now, Errol has disputed some of May's accounts, but she stood by her version in public. These legal battles are a major reason she became such a strong advocate for independence and resilience. So, yeah, that's a big issue. It's a big issue. All right, let us get back to your questions from the chat. Oh, where have they all gone? Where have they gone? Where? Oh, yeah, people who refer to me as Steffi. I mean, it's just gross. It's just gross. Nobody refers to me that way. Joe Rogan is still a libtard deep down. Yeah, you know, he's just a weather vane. He's just a weather vane. Like I've said this before, but he invited me on two shows. We were very positive, funny, and friendly. He said he really liked what I was doing, wanted to help my career. And then I criticized Annika Sparinet about something, and she basically whipped him into some retarded white knight frenzy. And then he invited me down for a third show without telling me it was going to be an ambush. And then he asked me about, oh my God, you know, the family breakup stuff. And I answered it all pretty well. He had queued up quotes of crazy things and so on, right? So, you know, he became this moral hero to white knight for Annika Sparinet. Very sad. And it's funny because he was complaining about family breakups, but he literally married a single mom. I mean, imagine being that rich and famous and marrying a single mom waitress, a cocktail waitress. So, you know, I mean, he was willing to have children with a woman who broke up her family, but apparently family breakups are really bad. And of course, he had Steve Tyler from Aerosmith on his show. Steve Tyler adopted a woman in order to continue to, adopted a minor in order to take her across straight lines. For his particularly unholy purposes. He didn't bring any of that up, right? Obviously, with with Steve Tyler. He's just a weather vane, like most people, right? So, all right. Let's see here. Yeah, if you feed the trolls, they'll just keep coming back. Like, try not to get goaded. I understand. I mean, it's they say outrageous things, and they have the hook. Right, and they have the worm on the hook. fight back. And it's very sad. All right. Boom, boom, boom. Steph lost prominence with his hair. Not quite sure what that means. I think it's unfortunate that a person would take time out of their day to bash someone on their show. How about they just live their own best life instead? Well, I mean, they don't have a best life. They don't have a best life. They don't have people who love them. They don't have children who love them. They don't have a wife who loves them. They don't have, I mean, it's, they come and they feel powerless in their lives. Like everybody knows how this goes, right? The trolls, they feel powerless in their lives because nobody likes them. And so the only way that they can get power is to come and troll and have people respond to them. And that feeds their sense of having some power or authority or control in your life. So, It's projection, right? Somebody says, I think that's right. I was quite an online bully or troll in World of Warcraft for years. Everything I said to others was really about myself. Yeah. Somebody says, that's wise of you to realize this. I noticed it about myself also when I accused others of being hypocritical when I was often myself. Yeah. Oh, so now they're talking about World of Warcraft, which is fan. Yeah, I often assume any attacks are just slander used to discredit people, especially if they're counterculture. Yeah, that's kind of true. But that doesn't mean that there aren't terrible people out there, and maybe Elon Musk is one of them. Certainly seems to be that way. All right. Let me just see here. I just want to make sure I get to questions, comments. Now they're talking about fishing. It's nice. It's nice that people are chatting about this. Steph, are you familiar with Jiddu Krishnamurti, 1895 to 1986? A philosopher, spiritual speaker from India, he did gather a big following, but dissolved it. No, it would be sort of like if I was a rock and roll guy writing his own songs rather than doing covers. It'd be like, well, are you aware of this song from this guy in India? And it's like, no, I mean, I enjoy reading other philosophers. I haven't done it much lately, ever since I finished my History of Philosophy series, which goes all the way from the pre-Socratics up to right before Immanuel Kant. It's a 22-part series. You can get that at freedomain.locals.com. You can just subscribe there and you get the 12 hours on the French Revolution and you get this 22-part series on the history of philosophers. Really, really great stuff. But no, I don't. I mean, if I'm writing my own songs, why do I want to learn other people's songs, right? If I'm writing my own books, why do I want to read obscure books from other places? I would rather create than absorb as a whole. So I don't generally read other philosophers. And if he's from India, I mean, I know a little bit about the history of Indian philosophy, and I assume it's just mostly nonsense mysticism. Because if it wasn't nonsense mysticism, see, here's the thing too. If somebody's in a kind of third world country and a philosopher and they live to a ripe old age, they probably have nothing of value to say, because he's 1895 to 1986. I mean, that's a long ass time, man. What was that, 89? 91. Yeah, so if you get to 91 in India, you're probably not saying anything particularly challenging. All right, let's see here. A question about forgiveness. How do you forgive yourself for acting without virtue in the past, however small? I know Christians teach forgiveness, but I'm curious about the philosopher's take. Yeah, so forgiveness is a virtue or a state of mind to be earned. To be earned. So I was a bit of a hound dog in my youth, and what can I say about that? Well, I wasn't taught any dating, romantic, or sexual morality. I was just coasting on hormones, and there was an attitude of permissiveness and hypersexuality that came out of the 70s when I was growing up, to put it mildly. It was just appalling, appalling what was going on in the 70s about this kind of stuff. So I can't know before I know. You know, does everybody, before they hear E equals MC squared, does everybody say, I was such an idiot for not knowing that beforehand? It's like, well, you can't know before you know. And I did work to study morals and virtues and honor and integrity, and I was sort of dragging myself in that direction. But it's sort of like if your children, like if you're a kid, right, and you're overfed, and your mom bans you from going outside, and there's only soda to drink, and the water is rusty, and there's only chips and cookies and chocolate and candy and just crap, right? And white bread. So, and then you end up overweight. Well, let's say you're 18 and you're 250 pounds. Let's say you're 60 pounds overweight, right? I mean, how do you feel about that? Well, you'd say, well, I should have eaten better, but there wasn't any good food. And I wasn't allowed outside to play. And I never had a bike. And the neighborhood was dangerous. And you can't go for walks. And you can't go to play. And like, whatever it is, right? So can you forgive yourself for being 250 pounds when you're 17 or 18? I think so. I think so. So the way that you earn forgiveness for past misdeeds is to do better, right? So the way that you can forgive yourself for being 250 pounds when you're 17, I don't think you should forgive yourself for being 250 pounds when you're 30, right? So you say, oh, I was too heavy, you know, and I can, circumstances and environment and so on, right? Or maybe you had a thyroid issue or, you know, the slow metabolism stuff that people say, I'm big boned, right? Oh, dinosaurs are big boned. So you can say, I forgive myself for being overweight as a teenager, but I have to earn forgiveness going forward by changing my behavior. Right. So, of course, I've never cheated on my wife. And I'm not on the prowl. I'm not on the look. I'm not anything like that. So I have a good romantic sexual morality now. And I've earned forgiveness for past misdeeds by having better present deeds. You know, when you're younger, self-discipline, or really at any age, self-discipline is just love for your future self. And if you weren't loved as a kid, which is usually why people do bad things, then you at least have to turn it around at some point, and you have to start loving your future self, right? So I have affection for me in my 80s, so I work out quite a lot now, right? I play pickleball, I go hiking, I do weights, and so on. Because I have affection for my future self, and I don't want to deliver to my future self a weak, hollow-boned, frail body. I want to deliver, like when I was 40, I wanted to deliver, I'm going to be 60 in a couple of months, I wanted to deliver to my 60-year-old self a, you know, reasonably, I'm not some super muscle guy, but, you know, obviously pretty robust, pretty strong. And there's almost nothing I want to do physically that I can't. Like, I can still go rock climbing. I can still sprint. I tried this the other day. I can still sprint. Most people don't even ever sprint after the age of 30. I can still sprint. I can still go on long hikes. I can still do an hour plus of pretty hard racket sports. So I can do the things that I want to do. And I'm still doing basically the same workout I did when I was trying to gain muscle for playing Macbeth in my early 20s. Early 20s? Yeah. Was I 20? Maybe 24. So having affection for your future self means having forgiveness for your past self. Making better decisions for the future is a great way to earn forgiveness for past misdeeds. So if you've done things wrong, in other words, if you've been a human being, right, and you've done things that are wrong, recognizing that they're wrong without excuses, because eventually, especially when you're an adult, it does come down to your choice, and saying, okay, I'm not going to do that wrong anymore, and I'm going to maybe promote some better things in the world, even if it's just socially, like in your social circle and so on. And the other way that you forgive yourself for past misdeeds is you stop associating with people who continue those misdeeds. So let's say you had a friend when you were both young and you both got drunk, went out, got into stupid fights and slept with trashy women, right? This was your life, right? And then you repent on that, right? And you say, well, that was bad, and you stop drinking and you stop getting into stupid fights and you stop sleeping with trashy women and so on. And let's say your friend continues. Well, you can't forgive yourself for your past misdeeds as long as you continue to enable your friend for his very current misdeeds. So, of course, you make the case for better behavior to your friend. But if he keeps going, well, you'll have a tough time forgiving yourself for your past misdeeds, oddly enough, if you continue forgiving your friend for his current misdeeds. because it means you haven't recognized them as foundational misdeeds that need to be stopped. So I hope that makes sense. I hope that makes sense. All right. Any other questions, challenges, issues, problems? Let me just go and check the chatty chat. Yeah. Oh, I need to close that down. Why is that? Oh, there we go. Okay. Let's see here. Oh, does this go back to the beginning? Because I lost some stuff at the beginning. Let me just go back here for a sec. Why did you turn off the jazz? Oh, that's just music that X plays when we start. Bum, bum. What? Oh, yeah. So the guy said, damn, the fall of this dork is really sad. That is not an argument, friend. And he said, what argument? I said, this guy's a dork because he is. There is no argument. he says, Stefan is the definition of lame, dude. Old dork that thinks he's a philosopher. Again, why? Do you ever say anything of value? How the fuck do people enjoy this? I don't know. I mean, honestly, just mute people. Just mute people. This is the same guy that literally begged his diminishing audience for donations. Some brilliant philosopher. Delightful. Yes, that's true. It is true that I ask for people to exchange value to value. I've put in 60,000 hours into philosophy to distill things down to a comprehensible rate. And I know that I provide a massive amount of value in the world, and I ask for people to donate at freedomain.com/donate to exchange value for value. Maybe you go to work and don't ask for money. Maybe you you see everyone else around you getting a big raise and you don't ask for a raise. Maybe you donate all of your time to people for free, but I expect people to exchange value for value. So I don't know why that is controversial. I mean, if you go to a restaurant and you eat a good meal, you should pay, right? I mean, the restaurant has provided value, right? So anyway, it's just kind of funny. What credibility do you even mean? I have to have credits to know an old douche is a douche. Oh, that's very funny. So this person, this troll obviously, is so unintelligent that they think that credits is the same as credibility. He says, what credibility do you even mean? I have to have credits to know an old douche is a douche. So he thinks that credibility is like credits. You know, in a video game, they'd say, put quarters in for credibility. You have 3 credibilities. Oh, dear. I wish to take out a line of credibility at the bank. Credibility is not the same as credits. Oh, my God. That is very funny. Stefan is literally rambling about nothing. It's true that some people can't follow my thoughts. Right? Some people can't follow my thoughts. Objectively, what flavor Monster Energy is superior? Get Izzy in here as an SME. I'm not sure what SME is, but I have not tried. I don't think I've tried Celsius once, which was kind of nice, but. Steph, how did you find playmates for your homeschooled only child when she was 5? Well, and we still have this relationship going at the moment, right? The credibility blockchain. That's right. It's not a credit union. It's a credibility union. They will give you credibility. I'm going to give you a magic wand that has people believe that you have authority when you don't. That's called a credit agency. I'd like a credibility card, please. Don't you mean credit card? No, I mean a credibility card. I mean something that I can wave in front of people that will have them believe me. A credibility card. I'd like to pay with my credibility card. No, you don't. Yes, I do. Okay, yes, you do. That's great. So someone many years ago, oh gosh, is it close to 16, 17 years ago, someone contacted me through my show, and we've been family, friends and gone through thick and thin over the last 16, 17 years. And so I've had people come to me through the show. I'm trying to think. I think everyone in my life has come to me through the show. I think everyone who's still in my life, yeah, I don't think there's anyone else. Everyone has come to me through the show. Now, when I was, when Izzy was very little, we took her on various activities and I'd chat with the parents. And one parent was like, "Hey, don't you have a podcast?" I'm like, "Maybe, maybe." And they turned out to be big fans. And so we hung out with them for a little bit. So I don't have any particular way of figuring this out for you, of course, right? MDE.TV. That's Sam Hyde's show. MDE. $1 million or something. MDE.TV. SHS episode 21, a blank slate. So you're going to have to go out into the world and you're going to have to share your values. And a lot of people will dislike you. Some people won't understand you, but the people who do like you, you can form good relationships with. All right, let's see here. James says, "And you think that Socrates, slightly later, caused philosophy to be much more centrally about morals? Was moral truth over-exaggerated by Socrates? Are there any drawbacks about good and evil extreme superlatives in such a way, do you think? Was the older puzzling abstract scenario philosophy and metaphysics being pushed to the side and morals brought to the forefront a good turn or maybe overbalanced, out of balance still in another way?" Right. "It's unusually trolly in here today." Well, you know, we're widening the net. Just a little bit. "I admire your ability to be immune to trolls." I mean, I was raised by trolls. I was taught by trolls. And yeah, look, I mean, so it's totally fine. See, here's the funny thing. And this is a funny thing that's an empathy thing. I don't mean like necessarily good or bad. It's just an empathy thing. So let me sort of explain to you how this works. So when I used to get more views, I was bigger in your mind and had more influence and more effect in your mind, which is totally fine. And then when I get fewer views, I look diminished, right? Again, I totally understand that. It makes sense. I used to play stadiums. Now I play clubs. So that makes sense. However, I'm not diminished within my own mind, right? That's from your view outside in, right? So he used to play stadiums, now he plays clubs, right? Maybe someday he'll play the park or I'll be a busker in the subway or maybe I'll just play to myself or whatever, right? Two. And so I look diminished to you and maybe there's pity or some sympathy or sorrow or something like that, but I'm not diminished within myself because I do not have a foundational relationship with the audience. I think I've been relatively immune to audience capture, you know, when your audience says, "You got to talk about this," and you end up talking about this, whatever, right? So I don't have foundationally a relationship with the audience. I have a relationship with philosophy, virtue, conscience, and people I love and who love me. That my relationship is that. My relationship is with philosophy, virtue, conscience, and love. Now, is that fundamentally dependent upon the size of the audience I have? And if I wanted a bigger, I mean, I know exactly what to do to get a bigger audience. I go back into politics. I talk about even more controversial stuff. I become more of an edgelord, all of that, right? So I know how to get more views. I've done it before. I went from nothing to, you know, 10 million views a month and 100,000 books a month. Like, no problem. I know how to do all of that. Now, do I want more audience at the expense of my conscience or at the expense of virtue or at the expense of people who love me? No. The audience numbers, right? The audience is a couple of hours a week. I spend a whole lot of time not live streaming, not doing shows. I spend time planning shows. I spend time, I'm working on a movie right now. I am working on a new book. I do a whole lot of things. And to do those things, it matters that people who care about me in my life care about what I'm doing and things like that, right? So I don't know if you've ever had this where you get a short amount of perhaps satisfaction and pleasure, but it comes at the long-term kind of unease or issues. So if I were to go against my conscience in order to get a bigger audience, I'm not saying that's necessarily the case, but if I were, right, then I would maybe get a little bit more happiness because there'd be 100 times the listeners than the 100 times the views or whatever it is, right? And there'd be more money coming in, I assume, because of that. Well, you spend most of your life not looking at the numbers on a screen, and you spend most of your life not spending money. And I'm not much of a spender anyway. I don't really like to. I mean, I'll invest, but I don't like to spend money on consumables, other than I have a weakness for some kinds of coffees. So if people say you are diminished, you have fallen from grace, you are lesser than, I totally understand. From your, like, if you love a band or a singer or a songwriter, and then they're away for a couple of years, you think, oh my God, they've been doing nothing because they've been doing nothing with you. But from the inside out, I've had a wonderful time over these last 6 years. I was happy to be, you know, the big swinging DYCK. I was happy to be the big shot. I thought it was fun. I thought it was interesting. I thought it was engaging. And I have a responsibility, I think, because I've been gifted, literally gifted, it's not earned it. I've been gifted this crazy brain and this communications ability and the capacity to solve problems that have bedazzled and bedeviled philosophers for thousands and thousands of years. I solved the problem of free will, of the simulation, of secular ethics. Like, I got a whole bunch of things that I've resolved. Whether people agree with me or not, doesn't really matter. I just know that they are resolved because I've gone through the logic. So I also have a responsibility to do maximum philosophy. And philosophy was getting very dangerous out there. Like, people were getting arrested. People were getting thrown in prison. They were getting attacked in prison. People were getting shot. And of course, all of that stuff was, I mean, it was in my inbox, right? Death threats, bomb threats, and so on. And so I felt full responsibility for my family and so on. I stepped back from the heavy politics stuff and focus on, I wrote Peaceful Parenting. I've written 4 books. Since deplatforming and done lots of other sort of great and fun and good work. And so there's a lot of extra philosophy out there because I sort of stepped back from the limelight, which I think is good because I have a 500-year plan for philosophy. I'm not kidding about that. It's like a 500-year plan. I got notes all over the place for a 500-year plan for philosophy. So I have to do maximum philosophy because I've been given this gift, which means I don't get to squander it for the sake of chasing numbers off a cliff, right? Again, the Charlie Crook stuff and other people. I mean, even Trump, my number of assassination attempts and so on. So, like, I understand when people say, oh, there's a big fall from grace and this and that. I mean, it makes sense from your perspective, but you have to try and look. I mean, if you want to, I think it's a useful thing to try and look at things from other people's perspective. And because when I'm not on your screen, in a sense, I cease to exist. And if you look at the numbers and you say, well, there are fewer numbers or lower numbers than there were before, therefore there's a diminishment. It's like, but that's not how it is from the inside out. If I had maintained my old pace and focus, I would probably not be here. And I'm happy to be here. And of course, I have a responsibility to your family and so on and all of that. So, did you ever sort out Taylor's ex? That's pretty funny. That's pretty funny. Do 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 do. Steph fundamentally changed my worldview thanks to his time on YouTube around 2013 to 2016. Ah, very nice. Well, thank you. All right. Why am I not able to? Sorry, my chat keeps flipping up and down here. It's kind of annoying to read. All right. Let's see here. Let's just get to any other questions that I didn't get to. And again, I really appreciate everyone dropping by today. A great and deep and lovely pleasure to chat with you all. Did you like Citizen Vigilante? I heard that there was a scene where the hero is having sex with a prostitute. So that's vile. So that's vile. That's very sad. I mean, he's supposed to be, what, an advocate for Europeans and whiteness, and he's having sex with a white prostitute, which is being trafficked, and he owns the building where the trafficking and prostitution is going on in. So I don't know the director, but having been a little bit around the theater and film world myself, I assume that the director wanted a scene in a brothel so he could audition a bunch of hot girls and hopefully sleep with them. So I think that's, Citizen Vigilante. I've seen a couple of clips, but Citizen Vigilante, I assume that he's supposed to be a hero, but then he sleeps with a prostitute that's in a building that he owns and runs. That's because he's got this whole thing about, like, I saw another clip where he's on a bus. I think it was posted by some economist. The Citizen Vigilante guy, the Arnie Hammer guy, he's on a bus and he says, "Well, don't you understand that if you don't pay your bus fare, it drives the prices up. There are social ramifications and social costs for you not paying your bus fare." And then he goes and pays for prostitutes and has prostitutes in the building that he owns. It's like, I don't know, man. What do you think is worse for society, not paying your bus fare or mass trafficked prostitutes? I mean, it's completely, again, I don't know, maybe it makes sense. I can't imagine how it makes sense in the movie as a whole, because again, I've just seen a couple of clips, but he's supporting human trafficking of white women and prostitution and this, that, and the other, and then he complains that some people aren't paying their bus fare. Ugh, gross. It's hideous. It's just hideous. Dun, dun. What are your thoughts on religious-themed OCD? Some people have horrifying, intrusive thoughts of blasphemy. How can philosophy be used to overcome this? Well, being punished for wrong think usually comes out of parental abuse for, quote, impoliteness, and so on. All right. Sorry, let me just catch up here. Here's a bit I actually did. You quite literally beg your audience for money. Now that's interesting. Oh, hey, John. That's interesting. You're back trolling again. John called in and I took him apart intellectually, so he's trolling. So that's interesting, right? So I ask my audience for money. Sure. Of course I do. Of course I do. I mean, I was a waiter. I asked people for tips, you know, tips welcome, blah, 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 right? So I don't know what's wrong with asking people for things. I mean, please help me understand this. If anybody wants to explain this to me, what is wrong with asking people for things? I don't know. I don't know what begging is. Begging is a way of framing asking something, right? Right. So if I go up to a woman, as I did many times in the past, I go up to a woman and say, hey, let's chat. And, you know, if I like her and she likes me, let's go on a date or whatever it is. So I'm asking for something. I go and say, hey, are you hiring? Like when I was a teenager and I wanted a job, are you hiring? Right. Or I go and ask for things. I ask for things in life. Right. I ask for my wife's hand in marriage. I ask for donations. I ask for things. I go to a restaurant and they say, what do you want? I say, no, I can't ask. I can't even tell you. You got to read my mind. Otherwise, I'm begging you. So when you ask people for things, is that begging? I don't know what that means exactly, but I do think it's kind of sad for people to say that if I ask for something, that's begging, because it means they then can ask for things, right? So yeah, I provide a lot of value in the world and I ask for reciprocal value. Yes, freedomain.com/donate. I would really appreciate your support for what it is that I do, for sure. And Socrates, by the by, also asked people to buy him lunch. So asking people for reciprocal value is fine. I don't like if you're playing music in the subway and you've got a sign that says, you know, tips welcome or whatever, you get your little guitar case and people throw some money in, are you begging? No, you're just providing value and hoping that people reciprocate. So I don't know what it means when, I genuinely don't know what it means when people say, well, what did John say here? You quite literally beg your audience for money. Well, and I don't have commercials. I don't do ads. I don't do ad reads. I don't have sponsorship. Like, you know, you get into something and then there's like 10 minutes in the middle for some VPN or whatever, right? So I don't do ads. And if you listen to a bunch of my shows, the fact that I haven't done ads has saved you dozens, hundreds, or maybe even thousands of hours, right? So if I save you 100 hours and I ask for a donation, I think that's fair. So yeah, it's I don't know why people have difficulty with asking for reciprocal value, right? I mean, if I go and help a friend move, and then I want him to come and help me move, and I say, hey, can you come and help me move? Is that begging him? Or is this like, well, I helped you move, I'd kind of appreciate it if you could do the back, right? So, yeah, it's strange. It's strange. Why is that? Why is it wrong to ask people to exchange value with you? What is consciousness? Consciousness is the self-aware part of the mind that can examine its own processes. Thoughts on Thomas Aquinas and the Five Proofs. I have a whole History of Philosophy series entry on Thomas Aquinas, so that's available at premium.freedomain.com. So if you want to look at my debate with John Balfour, the podcast number is 6101. 6101. We're comparing asking for lunch to giving you lots of money now. Ah, see, John, that's called moving the goalpost, right? That's called moving the goalpost. So what you said earlier is you beg your audience for money, and now you've changed it to lots of money. See, that's called moving the goalpost. It's really pathetic. It's really pathetic, right? So when have I ever said, I want you to donate $10,000. I want you to donate a billion Bitcoin, right? I just ask for donations. And they start at like, what, $5 a month? So why would you? And you don't, like, it's just so manipulative. I never know whether people are aware of this manipulation or not, right? I mean, I take donations of $5. It's fine. I'm never right. I mean, so you can't even get lunch for $5 now. So if I say it's like asking someone for lunch, like Socrates did, he now has to change it from me asking people for money or begging people for money to now asking for lots of money. Oh my gosh, that's so sad. I mean, that's very, and of course, you know, people can book calls. I do it completely for free. You know, massive expert philosophical feedback. I just did one this morning. A guy changed his life. And you can book me anytime. call.freedomain.com. Totally free. I mean, you have to let me publish it, but yeah, it's totally free. So that's funny, right? Bum, bum, bum. All right. So let's see here. So John has a problem with me asking for value when I'm providing value, but I don't think he's ever spoken out about taxation or the absolutely unpayable national debt and unfunded liabilities, right? Just shame guys that gave him a dollar. No, I never shamed someone. So yeah, just for those of you who don't know, it's kind of an interesting old story. So many years ago, somebody sent me a $2 donation and I posted that somebody had just sent me a $2 donation. I posted just the donation, no email or anything like that. And I said, I don't mean to sound ungrateful, but, that's all I said. I don't mean to sound ungrateful, but, right? And this drove people mad. And so I didn't shout to say, oh, you're a terrible person for only sending me $2. I don't mean to sound ungrateful, but if somebody's sending me $2, then I don't want them to send me $2. Because if all they can afford is $2, I don't want them to send, I want to say, like, don't send me the money. And I refund people who send me that, because if you only have $2, then you need to use it to get on a bus and get a job, like all of that, right? So yeah, I've not shamed people. Yeah, it's not like Steph has tenure. Yeah, so this John is a professor, right? He's a professor, so he has tenure and he gets money because of the government, because the government controls his cartel. Right, so, yeah. All right. Tip.freedomain.com. Yeah, tip.freedomain.com. All right. Let me just check here. People can ask for money and you not give them anything without shaming them. That's what we do with most people who ask. We ignore most. Yeah, of course. And like 95% of my audience doesn't donate and I don't shame them. But if somebody donates $2, first of all, I've got to track it. I've got to report it. It's extra labor. And if somebody doesn't have, and it was the same thing when I was a waiter. Like if I had a $100 bill and somebody gave me $102, I would give them their $2 back because I didn't want to take, if they couldn't afford to tip more than $2, they should keep that $2 because it's a bad thing. I sent you $50 10 years ago. Good deal for me. Yeah, it might be time to re-up a little bit. And the other thing too, I haven't raised my prices in 21 years, right? Like, I mean, I'm still taking $5, which is worth like $1.50 from 21 years ago. So the waiter actually provides a service though. The waiter actually provides a service though. But if you're consuming somebody's labor, by definition, they're providing you a service. Right? I mean, if you're watching a movie, by definition, the movie maker is providing you a service. And if you're watching my live stream, by definition, I'm providing you a service. So I'm sorry that basic definitions appear to be a challenge for you. Oh, that's funny. I'm consuming your content because I want to, but you're not providing me any service. It's like, but by definition, I am, right? Oh, that's funny. Steph, what do you think about people immortalizing their consciousness into AI so that it can be accessed by future generations, assuming the technology is possible? Would you consider it? I mean, I have programmed AIs with a bunch of my shows, with a bunch of my books and other kind of things as well. So, and here's the other thing, John, like, honestly, if you can do a better job live streaming and going to the world, you'll only be able to teach 1,000, maybe 2,000, maybe 3,000. Depending on, you know, the number of people you're teaching in university, you'll be able to reach millions and millions of people by live streaming. And it's a really, really great life. It's really, really a great life. And honestly, I know we've had our differences, but if you wanted to live stream and thus reach thousands of times more people than you ever could as a philosophy professor, I would absolutely help set you up. I would have you on, we'd get you going and all of that. John says, what you do isn't labor. It's completely up to the people watching it if it has any value at all. What I do isn't labor. Oh, he must be a Marxist or something like that. So what you're saying is the 60,000 hours that I put into philosophy, the people I've interviewed, the thousands and thousands of books that I've read, the massive amount of higher education, the graduate degree and all of that, that none of that involved labor. Interesting. Interesting. So talking and providing wisdom and insights that people find valuable is not labor. I'm not sure what that means. Because what I do is talk to people about philosophy, and what you do is talk to people about philosophy. So if I shouldn't get paid, why should you get paid? Because what you do is talk to people about philosophy, I assume badly, and what I do is talk to people about philosophy, which is well. So if it's not labor, then why should you get paid if I don't get paid? Whatever, right? So, that's funny. It's completely up to the people watching if it has any value at all. Well, see, now that's moving the goalposts, right? Because he said the waiter provides a service, right? And so I said, I am providing a service if you're listening to my content. And then he says, he's moved from service to labor. To value, right? He says, you're not providing a service. And now he switched it to labor and to value. And no, it's not feeding a troll. Maybe it is, but what I'm doing is I'm just trying to tell you how to rationally analyze arguments that are aimed at you, right? I mean, maybe I am. I mean, tell me, hit me with a why. Am I feeding a troll? Hit me with a why. If I am, I will apologize and move on. I'll let the audience decide why or N, if I am. I find these arguments interesting to analyze, but I don't want to be feeding trolls because I'm not bothered by the troll. I just find it interesting. Yeah, if it's up to the listener, why can't I decide to donate lots of credibility? Well, here's the thing. You can donate credibility. So I've said to people, you know, if you don't have any particular money, that's totally fine. Then what you can do is share the arguments. You can share my videos. If I'm too controversial, you can just share the content of what I talk about and so on. So I've always said to people, you can donate time for sure. You can share the work that I do. You can share my books. You can share arguments. You can argue UPB or universal ethics without ever talking about me at all and all of that, right? So somebody says, engaging, not necessarily feeding the troll. And somebody says, no, you're highlighting toxic behavior and teaching us, as always. Well, thanks, Zimph. I hope things are going well in the stuff that you've talked to me about privately. Steph, have you considered quitting philosophy for stand-up? Could be the move. I like stand-up. I've always been tempted. I did it once in Montreal in my 20s. I got up and did stand up and I quite enjoyed it. I think I would be good at it, but I wouldn't say that jokes fly. I'm good at ad-libbing stuff sometimes, but jokes, the sort of written jokes, don't sort of fly into my mind particularly. All right. I don't know. I do like the rebuttals, though. It could be feeding. How many times have you and us tried to get him to understand? Well, no, but I'm not trying to get John to understand anything. I'm not trying to get John to understand anything. He's not going to. All right. Well, listen, guys, I really appreciate your time. You'd be excellent at crowd work. I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think it would be a lot of fun. And I did see, who's your, I'm not your guru, I think it is. By Giant Lantern Jaw, Anthony, someone or other. And, I mean, he's completely wrecked his voice doing this kind of work. But Awaken the Giant Within, what's his name? God, I can't remember his name. Anyway, talking to people in a big crowd and doing some of that sort of live self-knowledge work and all of that. I guess I did a little bit of that on the Sam Hyde show and so on. But the problem is, you know, I always have to deal with the problem of violence and cancellation and deplatforming and bomb threats and blah, 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 blah. So it's Tony Robbins. Thank you very much, Tony Robbins. See, he stole himself from my very brain, Tony Robbins. Yeah, I think that stuff. Well, you know, I'm still a relatively young philosopher. I am Gandalf in terms of longevity, at least I hope. My mother has been about as healthy as a coke addict, and she's in her late 90s. So hopefully I'll have got a long way to go, and I'm certainly healthier than her. So maybe at some point when things have cooled down, I think they're getting better as far as free speech goes for a while. And certainly it's nice to be back on X. So it certainly could be the case that I can get out there and do some of that lovely public crowd work again, because I would love to do that kind of stuff. So, all right, get out of the studio, get out of my dreams, get into my car. Have yourself a wonderful day, everyone. Thank you for a great, great conversation, trolls and all. And we will talk to you tomorrow. Bye. I think we'll just do donors. Yeah, we'll do donors. 10 a.m. tomorrow, James. Just do donors only on the X platform. Let's just do that because. I do think better when I'm walking around a little. So, all right. Lots of love, everyone. Freedomain.com/donate. Bye.